Legislation is changing. Budgets are shifting. And terms like one big beautiful bill can feel anything but beautiful. That's where BHM CPA Group steps in. BHM's purpose is to simplify the complex. Their team is trained to meet today's challenges with real-world solutions in tax, accounting, and business planning. Get the clarity you deserve so that your business can thrive. Don't wait. Visit BHMCPAGroup.com. That's BHMCPAGroup.com. BHM, because running a business is hard enough. Your finances shouldn't be.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hello and welcome to episode 192 of What Most People Think. I'm in a good mood, man. I went to a mate's 50th at the weekend, and that's my mate Luke. Happy birthday, Luke. We had a good laugh. He's like me, he likes his house music, so it was like a bit of a club night. It was a lot of people out there dancing who might have had to have some ibuprofen the following day. But one thing I realised is if you just have older friends. My friends on average, this group of lads in particular, are all about roughly 4 to 5 years older than me. So every single time they go through, you know, they've all been becoming 50 recently, I say to them, happy birthday, and I am significantly younger than you. I hope this helps. Just drop that in every time, just to remind them, okay? It makes me feel young. Just befriend people who are older than you. I saw Keir Starmer. I don't know if you saw this last week. Keir and Rishi are going toe-to-toe on who can look toughest on Law and Order, and Keir Starmer gave this very strange speech where he said he was talking about some constituents that had told him about the smell of cannabis, and Keir was getting very upset, and they sit there with their window open and there's a smell of cannabis coming into it, and it was just such a weird thing to go on. Like, obviously, if you live in a place where it stinks of weed all the time, you know, that I guess that is annoying, but, you know, from a politics point of view, surely you either express a view on what you thought about cannabis, whether or not police should go harder for possession. I think that would go against public opinion at this point. So you just thought, oh, I know I can seem tough. I'm going to seem really cross about the smell of cannabis. Just everywhere. Everywhere you go now. Cannabis. Very noxious smell. Or if you're into your ganja, maybe not so much. And then meanwhile, you've got the Tories getting rid of laughing gas. They're going to make laughing gas illegal. It's just so funny. At this point, we've got all these problems. The two main leaders of the two parties are just kind of going, one of them's going to go, you know, illegal drugs. I want to make them illegal. And Rishi is just gone, right. All right, Keir's done cannabis. What's left for me? I'll do laughing gas. I mean, I feel like there are more important things, but there you go. Steady the ship, Rishi, though. There's certainly, I know that there was an outlier poll, which I referenced last week, that seems to have corrected a little bit, and the Tories haven't caught up quite as much as that suggested. But there is definitely a steady the ship Rishi effect. I mean, if you want to put it in cricket terms, I think the Tories were 36-8 when Rishi came to the wicket, and he's rebuilt to 84-8. Now, this is third innings, so it's not going to set Labour much of a target. So he needs someone to stay with him. I think he needs to maybe post a run chase of about 160 to make it interesting to Labour. But I'd say Labour were still, you know, on task to win by about eight wickets. I've got an announcement. I've got a text. Is that what it sounds like on Love Island? I've got a new book coming out. So this podcast should be going up on Thursday, and it is available for pre-order now. It's called The British Bloke Explained. Now, let me explain. I fucked it up already. It's called The British Bloke Decoded. It's called The British Bloke Decoded. And the reason for it is, you know, men and blokes, we've been sort of getting a tough time in the media over the last few years. And I thought, what have I got a lot of experience in being is a bloke, right? I've got 46 years of solid research in the field. And I kind of came to realise, you know, and this sort of plays into the tour a little bit as well. But I am sort of the average bloke, you know, I'm nearly 5'9". I'm probably nearer to 5'8" in fairness. I'm just over 13 stone. I've got size 9 feet. My favourite food is curry. My favourite drink is lager. You know, I went through everything. I thought I am bang smack in the middle of everything. So I've sort of written a book which is supposed to be, you know, a bit insightful, but mostly funny. Just trying to explain men's crapness. You know, I say that there's no adverts on this podcast. Bear with me. But men's kind of crapness and weirdness, but also our splendour. Let's give men, blokes in particular, a bit of credit. So listen, if you listen to this podcast and the Patreon thing is not something you're quite up for, or, you know, you haven't been to a tour show yet, you could do me such a solid right now, which is go to my Twitter page or on Amazon, just type in Jeff Norcott, the British Bloke Decoded, and pre-order it. And I'll tell you why pre-orders are so important, because last time, I'm just fucking ignorant. It always takes me a while to work stuff out, is that I didn't realise that every single order, from the moment it goes available from pre-orders to the week that it fully comes out, goes for your first week's sale. So that could be like, you know, 20 weeks. And that is how they do the Sunday Times bestseller list. So all these fucking, you know, all these posh novelists, they know this. Novelists? Authors, they know this. They arrange everything. I'm just working it out. So if you could all do me a solid, I could just be a Sunday Times bestseller, even if it's only on the list for 1 week and then it drops out forever. That I can take that to the bank. If you've enjoyed this podcast and you just thought there's one thing you could do for me, is just pre-order the book. And I don't even mean pre-order it if you didn't want it. I mean, if you're going to get the book at some point, just pre-order it, and I'd appreciate it very greatly. New patrons. Now, because there was no new patrons this week. Fucking no, that's the first time that's happened in a long time. So this is why I'm selling it hard. VIP, remember, if you're a VIP patron, when they do the patron-only episodes, of which there's another one coming soon, you have a guaranteed question in it, as long as the question isn't inferring that some celebrity is a nonce. Unless they are a nonce, you know, then I'm happy to deal with it. But I thought, you know, given this week that there are no new patrons, I'll just give a shout-out to some existing ones. So let's give a shout-out to some board members. Laura Smart. Johan Ridderstrom. Did I ever read your name out, Johan? Because I don't know what I said your name sounded like before, but Johan Ridderstrom, you just sound like, you are one of the backup bass guitarists in Metallica. You know, as these rock bands get fucking old now, and some of them just have needed elbow operations, you just get some guy, Johan Ridderstrom. We've got Paul Roberts, who's just like, that is the most English name ever. And Adam Lewis, my friend Adam, who lives out there in Denmark. Let's give a couple of shouts out to some VIPs, David Allen and Alex Williams. All right, let's go on to the main talking point now. So our super patron, David Demain, picks up some things from last week's show where we had Francis Foster. And David mentions that in terms of dull leaders and effectiveness, Clement Attlee was a bland character, especially in contrast to Churchill. Yet he led Labour to an enormous majority in 1945, a government which created the welfare state as we knew it, we know it. And the Tories had Harold Macmillan, a dry Etonian type. However, his work as PM and Chancellor before that lifted the UK out of post-World War II austerity. He led the Tories to an increased majority in 1959. So, yeah, I guess there is form for kind of boring guys doing the business. But here's the difference maybe, David, is that that was before we had rolling news and social media. Were those guys memeable, you know? That's what you need. Could you meme Clement Attlee? Did he have a funny voice? Did he have a little funny expression? Did he ruffle his hair? See, you know, I mean, did Harold Macmillan have a monocle? You know, it's one of those things in modern politics where you'd think it'd be a stick to beat him with, but kids love that shit. What most people think. Okay, do a quick thank you and a fuck you. So the thank you is to Hamza Yousef for proving, you know, well, I mean, it is interesting, isn't it? With all the talk we have about the UK and people often saying it's racist and, you know, it's a bigoted and horrible country. We now have a situation where the First Minister of Scotland is Asian and a Muslim. Rishi is Anglo-Indian and is a Hindu. You know, I think the leader of the opposition in Scotland is Anas Sarwar, obviously Sadiq Khan in London. I think how many more of these things have to happen where you go, well, actually, compared to a lot of European countries, this is incredibly diverse and progressive, but a lot of people still want to talk about, you know, Britain, like, it's on fire. This country's burning. While this country, well, when did that word suddenly become such a popular way of describing what's happening. They've got no more extremes left to go to, have they? It's on fire. It's burning. I mean, they don't realise, people that talk like that, how much they sound like hellfire and damnation Christians, right? Which would probably be everything that they claim to oppose. But it's another example of language inflation, isn't it? It's the same as pandemic. Now, everything is a pandemic. We've got an obesity pandemic, got a violence pandemic, we've got an antisocial pandemic. So all that will happen is the word pandemic will eventually mean quite a lot of. It'll be like literally, won't it? It'll just mean, yeah, there's a fair bit of it. Yeah. So if you've got some delivery drivers dropping off, you know, some parcels, you go, is there a lot there? Yeah, there's a pandemic. There's a pandemic of parcels, meaning that there's a few. And you know, the interesting thing about Humza Yousaf coming to power is that who will it make it easier for? Because you know, he's not going to be Nicola Sturgeon. Sturgeon, whatever you thought of her, clearly held together the SNP too, certainly electorally, maybe not in terms of the membership. But Humza Yousaf, I don't think he's quite the same caliber of politician. So will he make it easier for Labour or the Tories? I think, you know, what we now can see is that there's a wing of the SNP which is more small C conservative, and it depends whether or not they then think, well, you know, is this my party? Will I, it's going to be hard for them if they're nationalists to go to the Conservative Party. Maybe old fucking Lucky Keir just keeps sweeping it all up. You know, this guy, nothing he is doing or saying has really landed. No big policy, no ideas, and yet everyone around him is just, you know those bits in the films where the guy puts a gun in his mouth and just shoots himself in the head? That is what has happened to all of Keir Starmer's political opponents. So I guess that is going to be good news for Labour in Scotland, because let's be honest, in terms of Labour winning a majority or a big majority, Scotland is the real key to it. If they can win 20 seats there, you know, that's going to make it a lot easier for them. But having said that, Keir Starmer did send out a tweet congratulating Humza Yousaf and noting the historical significance of there being a first, non-white First Minister of Scotland. But in the same tweet, he said, basically, oh, yeah, congratulations, this is a historic moment. And then without, like, even saying however, he just went, the SNP cannot deliver in Scotland, vote Labour. It was almost like a cut and shut of a tweet, wasn't it? You go, well, there's two separate tweets. He's gone, fuck it, I'll just bang them out together. And it just, I don't think that was, either you think, if you think this is a historic moment, right, then just pay homage to that and maybe do a separate tweet. It was a bit weird. But he wants it though, Keir, doesn't he? I've noticed recently in interviews and on his podcast sort of tours, he keeps saying, look, this isn't about me. It's not about me. This is not. If someone keeps saying that, you're going, yeah, maybe it is. Look, I'm not. It's not about me getting into number 10 and putting the new curtains I've already picked out and the furniture that I've currently got on order. I think he wants it, man. I agree that maybe when he started his life or even his political life, this might not be what he wanted. But every interview I hear with him, this guy, and nothing wrong with wanting to be Prime Minister, but what will he sacrifice in the process? There's plenty now. He's got plenty of fucking 180 Keirs to his name. I mean, even on the cannabis thing, he's gone from saying, it's not an immediate priority, but decriminalisation is something any government would look at, to going, the smell of cannabis fucks me right off. I'm well hard. Okay, we have our guest this week. It's a guest show this week, and we have Zoe Lyons on the show. And I just enjoyed the chat with Zoe so much. I will say up front, if it ends up sounding like a chat between two old mates, then that's kind of what it was, because we started with the same agency at the same time. And Zoe is just, you know, people just so good at stand-up. She's got all the skill set that you need. She's got great delivery, got great act outs, impersonations. Great observations. She's brilliant. And we had a chat about the way the comedy circuit is going. We also had a chat about, you know, about what happened with Brexit and the kind of comedy that people were doing, and where sometimes that was, you know, ill-judged. It was a really great chat, and I hope you enjoy it. So this is the conversation with the brilliant Zoe Lyons. And I'm pleased to welcome to what most people think this week is my friend, colleague, and one-time Murph Control stable mate, Zoe Lyons. Zoe, welcome to the show.
Lovely to see you, Jeff. It's been so long.
It has.
We used to work with each other all the time.
Well, this is what I was thinking was we were signed to an agency called Merv Control with the inimitable Jeff Whiting, who everyone imitates, yeah, which is often the case for inimitable people. And he's actually cropped up on the podcast quite a lot. But I was thinking back to those days. One of the things about being a Merv Control act was you drove a lot and you did a lot in the West Country. Do you have a memory of a sort of weirdest or furthest away gig?
Oh, God. I've got several down that way. I remember doing one for Jeff down in Plymouth. This one always sticks in my head. Because, you know, those days it was very much hand-to-mouth existence.
Yes.
It was, you know, you were getting a small amount of cash that just about covered your petrol, maybe a sandwich, if you were lucky, you know, if you were feeling extravagant. Yeah. I remember driving to that one in Plymouth. Did you ever do that one in Plymouth that was in, like, a little basement room?
Yes.
Like a little sort of
Club Fandango.
Bar. Club Fandango. I mean, could it sound more Benidorm? It's Club Fandango.
Yeah.
And there was a tiny little, you sort of performed in the corner. It had like painted tables, as any place called Club Fandango would.
And do you know the guy that ran it? Everyone thought, just called him Andy Fandango for so long.
I think
people thought that was his name eventually.
His actual name. I played that gig more times than I care to mention. I remember driving to it once and thinking, right, if I drive at a sensible speed, I'll just about be able to cope on the petrol that I've got, you know, money-wise, have a sandwich, and I'll probably make a tenner. And as I drove down to Plymouth, I got flashed by a speed camera, and I just went, well, I'm already minus 50 quid now.
And I have to take the sandwich back, get the receipt. I mean, now, it's interesting you mention it because obviously the economics of doing stand-up then could be tight when you were starting out. But even as you were saying about petrol and sandwiches, I was thinking, well, God, if there's two things that cost loads more now, it's petrol, petrol and sandwiches.
Yeah, isn't it? It's, I mean, it was just about manageable, I think, when we started.
Hmm.
And if you were savvy with your trains, you'd be able to sort of book way in advance and get really cheap tickets and make long-distance gigs doable. But now it's just, you know, I don't know how people are doing it. It's really, really tricky.
Well, that's what I was wondering, is are they doing it? Because now, because when we were getting going in the early noughties, you know, being a circuit comic was an end in itself. And also it was, you know, once you got decent at it, you could earn okay money. But it's very hard to see what the motivation for a young comic now is to go to Bodmin on a Bude on a Wednesday. You know, it's not a goal these days, is it?
No. And I think when we started, you know, it was just gig as much as possible anywhere. We went literally anywhere, didn't we?
Yes,
we were just driving the whole time. I remember giving myself repetitive strain injury in my elbows because my steering wheel used to vibrate slightly. And I'd driven for so long and for so many hours, my elbows went. I mean, I literally knocked my elbows out of joint driving.
I had back trouble in my late 20s just because of the amount of. I did, I think, in the first year that I was a stand-up, like a proper fully working, I did 55,000 miles.
I wasn't far off that. Yeah, my car used to piss out exhaust fumes into the car. So by the time I got home, I was just
sleeping
off my face on exhaust fumes. Yeah. I remember the exhaust fell off on the M25 once. It fell off. And I remember thinking, why is there a tractor following me? Because it just sounded like behind me. And it was when I got out of the car, I went, oh, I don't have an exhaust anymore. It's gone. Yeah. Yeah. Hard.
But I mean, the thing is, I mean, at the risk of, you know, and I always worry that I'll sound like an old fart when I talk about this stuff. But that is, you know, the only way to get good at stand up is to do it. Like, you can, if you want to play acoustic guitar, you can sit in your house and you can probably get up to a level of competence that if you can keep your nerves when you're in front of an audience, you can deliver that skill set. Whereas stand up really isn't a thing unless people are watching it. So that's what I think. It's all, you know, people have a different sort of approach to getting known or getting a profile now. But when it comes down to it, the fundamentals of the talent can only be learned one way, right?
I would think so. Yeah. I mean, I know that people are sort of getting bigger profiles online, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I've yet to see somebody who's got a massive online profile do a live show. I'd be interested to see how those skills, transfer, you know.
Maybe they have to sort of recreate their own house so that when they hold the camera in front of them, they have to build this fucking giant set. Here's me with my stripped down stuff. I mean, I suppose that for the punters that go and see that, they're sort of not necessarily expecting it to be amazing, but it's like I get to see that person that I look at in my phone, in my hand all day long. I get to be in a room with that person.
Which is a bit like sort of seeing bands, isn't it? When we were kids, it was that sort of thing that was, I don't know. But it's a very different thing being out on stage in front of a live audience. It really, really is. And they change so much as well, you know. There's so many different variables that can happen in a live room. So, yeah, it's only dealing with it and experiencing it that you get any good at it.
And there is a change in of the guard just in terms of... But I do think, this is one thing I do think, the stuff that works well with punters, I don't think changes that much over time. They really like observational humour delivered well, right? That's still where the fish are biting, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, my audience, I'm on tour at the minute. My audience are definitely getting older. You know, this is probably the last tour I do because it's the last year I'll get out of them, ring out of them. but I'm enjoying it so much. It's so much fun. And it is, it's just having a laugh. Yes. We're having a laugh. Yeah, that's what it is. And I've got a weird demographic, my audience. My audience at the moment is quite strange. It's sort of a mixture of Radio 4 listeners. And then every now and again, I get really young people coming along. Well, where have you found me from? It's quite interesting. It is quite interesting. It's quite nice. I was in Glasgow a few weeks ago, and after the tour, I had met up with some friends after the gig, the show. And these two young girls came up to me, were in their 20s, who'd been to the show, and they were like, we loved it so much, you know, blah, 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 blah. And they went, and look at you staying out having a drink. Good for you. I hope I'm like that when I'm your age. I'm like, Christ, I'm not dead, mate.
Yeah, get out of my face. Right? Look at
really
you
made
staying
me laugh.
Having a drink. Well, you know, you say, you know, back in the Jonglers days, I would have stayed in the venue and had a drink. With the punters. I mean, that used to be a thing. I was thinking about that the other day. If you think about the sensitivities of the modern workplace, the fact that they used to allow predominantly male comedians, right, to stay in a venue with loads of Hindus and gave them drinks tokens.
Yeah.
Are you mental?
Yeah. I know. God. I usually couldn't wait to get out of a Jonglers. My car was started before I'd even left the stage, I think, most times. I used to, I had some horrific times there. Nottingham Jonglers.
That was an intimidating venue, wasn't it?
It was because really intimidating. You'd turn up and there'd be like 40 blokes dressed as Robin Hood all off their heads on coke, which I don't remember from Maid Marian. And I remember the floor manager once, I remember walking into the room and just going, oh my God, they are going to hate me. I thought, I've got to do 20 minutes in front of coked up Robin Hoods. And I thought, what am I going to do? And the floor manager just came up to me and went, if you get to 12, that's fine. And I was like, yes.
I mean, it is easy to forget how stressful and intimidating those gigs could be, because I think in the noughties, certainly up until the credit crunch, people were just a bit more leery. People were jacked up on cheap credit and stuff. And there was certainly a reckoning that happened after the credit crunch we had a lot more comedy on telly, and I noticed that the behaviour of punters got a lot better. You know, stereotypically, people tend to think, well, society's getting worse, everything's getting worse. I tell you, one thing that's got better is punters' behaviour, because when people talk about heckles now, the only thing you can really say is, well, they're distractions. It's when people act silly. It's not... But then there were some Christmas gigs where, you know, I was trembling to go on in front of, like, a room of very working class, you know, about 400 people at somewhere like Nottingham Jonglers, almost all of them were in groups of stags or hens. I used to think of it, I don't know if you remember that film Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers, when all the orcs are standing there banging their things on the floor. So it felt like, whereas now, you know, we're lucky enough to tour, it's a cooperative endeavour with people that like what you do. Then it felt like a fight that you had to win.
Yeah, I often cried. I remember once sitting outside of a Jonglers, can't remember which one it was, and crying and thinking, so you're these people's entertainment. They've rented, hired a bloody babysitter for the night, and you're having a cry before you go on. I mean, something in this equation isn't right. And it was after that I stopped doing them. I was like, I can't do this anymore. This is silly. I'm supposed to be people's entertainment, and I'm having a weep, a gentle little weep before I go on.
I mean, I always thought the tears of the clown thing was something that it shouldn't happen that close to the performance itself.
Just in the green room.
And then certainly not when you come on and they're like, has she been crying? Well, I mean, it can happen. I saw one again. This was a Nottingham Jongleurs. This was a Christmas gig, and a very good comic who I won't name went on, and it went bad. And then you know that thing like sometimes those high status male comics would do where they go, I'm going down in flames. And so they would make it worse. I can remember at one point through the sort of jeers and people calling him a wanker, I heard him go, I was never a happy boy, really.
Oh, God, that's so revealing, isn't it?
It was really fun.
That's really tragic.
And then he toughed it out up there. But then I remember he walked straight into the dressing room without breaking stride, got a pint glass, got a bottle of red wine, and just turned the red wine bowl into the pint and filled it up.
Wow. Yeah. I don't blame him.
When you started, you trained in acting at the Poor School in London. I remember at that time, was there any kind of like sort of snobbishness from comics about the acting thing? Because I can remember there was a very Alfrey thing of like, no, man, it's comedy pure and applied or nothing.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it would get mentioned. And of course it would, because I would do things like a warm-up stretch before I went on stage. So you try and do that in a green room full of comics and then not have the piss taken out of you. But I would, just to sort of get out of my head, you know, get out of my mind, I'd do a little gentle warm-up stretch, and I'd think people were like, what the fuck?
Vocal exercises?
No, I never went that far. I never went that far.
Should have.
Or did I? Maybe in the early days, just because I was nervous and I used to speak so quickly on stage and I used to stumble a lot because I was so, so nervous. I used to just rattle through everything. I never left any gaps in case anybody interjected. Like a sort of, it was armour so that nothing got in between the cracks. I would speak so quickly because I was terrified most of the time.
I mean, green rooms back then, you know, there is greater female representation on the circuit now. But back then, there really wasn't that much. And it wasn't so much like that the green rooms were macho in the sense that blokes were opening beer bottles with their teeth. But
usually me, to be fair, Jeff. Slapping it off a table. Yeah.
Making the open spot bite the end off your cigar.
Yeah, exactly. I don't ever remember feeling intimidated or made to feel small within green rooms. I really don't. It was more audiences that had an issue, to be fair.
Yeah.
I mean, the only thing was that you were always just the only woman on. So you were always, you know, because you were visually different on stage when you came out, you were basically the spesh act.
Yeah.
You know, it was bloke, chuck a bird on, bloke, and people would go, oh, it's a special act, right, okay, we'll go and have a wee or, you know, have a pint. So you were always just the odd one out, and that's when that got, that was dull, that was hard to deal with, but I always loved the camaraderie and the friendship and the fun in green rooms. I was really delighted in other comics' company, of course,
That was the thing, it wasn't like, obviously, you know, there would have been examples of certain people, but broadly speaking, as you say, it wasn't sort of toxic, but there were certain things that used to happen that I wonder now if a younger comic might take issue. Like, there used to be that thing where you're about to go on and someone would go, don't fuck it up, you know, just to see if they could get in your head and stuff like that. Whereas, you know, I wonder now if stuff like that happened, by the Monday, there'd be a Twitter thread about it. Just to say.
Well, I'd still say that to somebody. as a laugh. Don't fuck it up.
You know, if somebody's saying don't fuck it up makes you fuck it up, maybe you were always going to fuck it up was always
going to fuck it up. I mean, that's if you can't handle that, then perhaps you're in the wrong business.
I mean, it's the status of gigs themselves now, because of course now we've got clip culture where everybody has got to at any given point just be uploading clips of them doing stand-up. What do you think about that? Is that something that does your head in, or have you kind of, are you dabbling in getting stuff online?
That dabbling, I dabble in it. Yeah. I'm doing it at the minute because I am, you know, trying to sell tickets. So I'm doing it at the moment. I think probably once the tour's finished, that'll end.
Yeah.
I mean, it's... At first, I was like, oh, God, do we have to do this as well? But, you know, listen, the world changes and technology changes and you can rail against it or you can just let it go with it and have a flow with it and just have a bit of fun with it, actually. I've decided to take everything a lot less seriously and put away my hang-ups and, you know, if this is the way things are going, my protests are not going to stop the tide. So I will participate in a form that is fun for me and is going with the flow. That's how I feel about it. I certainly wouldn't want to get to a point where I have to. I know that, you know, if you want to keep that going and you want to keep building on those audiences, then it is a constant thing and it is a daily thing and it is a job in itself. And I don't want that as a job. I'd rather work for the Woodland Trust. That's not for me.
No.
I'll do it to a degree, but I don't want that as my full-time job. And if at some point comedy became that, then I would gently moonwalk into the distance.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because we spoke about the economics of people doing gigs now. There's a very real chance that at some point that people will market gigs and say, well, the fee is, you know, it's not a great fee, but it's very clippable, you know,
or
we do videos. Yeah. So we could have a total reversal whereby people are doing club gigs for the clips. That's already happening, you know.
Well, like a version of our gig, literally a gig economy. I mean, that's what that'll become, isn't it? That is your absolute... ultimate gig economy. I don't think you're too far off the mark with that. But then it all comes down to how you value a human and how you value entertainment and how you value interaction and how you value community and how you value all of those things. And, there's nothing beats a room full of live people having performed in front of dead people.
Come on, your punters aren't that old, Zoe.
Not yet. We're not quite cruise ship material yet. But but just that coming together and having a laugh and having a drink and a chat with people in the interval even is just, listen, leaving our houses.
That became a radical act, didn't it, after the last few years.
Yeah, I think it's really important. And so much is available to us by not leaving our houses. And then society sits down and goes, I'm lonely. And you go, well, why do you think you're lonely, you dick? You know, you haven't left your bloody house for a week.
Well, no, I think that is where comedy keeps its appeal. And I think there's so many, like, you know, acts touring at the moment and that's great. I think that... Like you said, that's my fear is you go, all right, I've got some video footage over a period of time. I'll knock some of them out and people can see. But the point where you go, I have to keep doing that, because there's some accounts, and these aren't stand-up accounts as such, but like there's one account where it's really funny on TikTok where this woman, her dog and her cat fight, and she commentates, play fine, but she commentates on it like it's boxing. It's so funny. It's really good. But once you are that person...
Yeah,
that is what worries me. That if people come to you for one particular thing, you then get frozen in that moment in time. Whereas stand up, at least with stand up, as long as what you're talking about is funny, you can do, you know, a lot of different things. That's what I worry. If your constant thing is to say, you know, dogs do this, cats do this, you know, which is, look, I've done that as a routine in the past, or one age group does this or one age group does that. That is what I worry, because that. Eventually, you're going to get bored with that, or the punters are going to get bored with that.
Yeah, and your punters will have a certain expectation when they come along to the show. And I do wonder about sort of attention span over the course of an hour and a half. It's
Would you think we'd have to start doing jump cuts in our set? So we'll just be at like what feels like the end of a routine, and then we suddenly change our clothes and we're in a different place.
And I mean, when it gets like that, I'll bail in.
Yeah.
Like I say. It's you can't hold back the tide, but sometimes you don't want to be taken away with it either. So I think it's about finding a sort of real. I'm when I finish this tour, I'm going to take a long, hard sit down and think about how I'm going to go into the future and what I want to do.
I mean, a good thing, I suppose, with podcasting for someone in my age is it's an elite. I mean, podcasting still sounds new when it's completely not. It's just, you know, you get to a certain age where you think things are new that aren't. I still think the show Tipping Point is like a new quiz show.
Oh, yeah. What, season 20 or whatever it is?
Yeah, I like this new wacky, just like The Chase. It's great to see all these new quiz shows coming out. So the podcast at least is just radio. At least I get that. People talking, people chatting and stuff. But there's a degree, you know, with technological wizardry that's needed where I think, I don't know, I don't know if I'll ever get my head around that. I don't.
Are you quite tech savvy?
Not really. I could get up to, I mean, the reason I can edit my own podcast was just because I had reason to edit things over a period of time. The problem with like technology is like trying to join a show at like season 20, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like Facebook. If when you look at Facebook, it makes sense to you because you were there from the beginning. You saw all the previous iterations. It's like when you try and show an older person now, they've no reason to understand why that bit's there or that bit's there.
Sure.
And it's the same with like editing software. And it's so fucking hard to learn new stuff, isn't it? I mean, and it makes you sad as well.
Yeah. I mean, I'm reasonably okay with it. I don't know. I mean, I've got a microphone and headphones on. I look like I know what I'm doing here, don't I?
Select input. You know, I can do that shit all day long.
Oh, I can just about do that.
But if it goes wrong, I get scared. I have to leave the room, breathe.
Throw the computer out of the window and move on. I mean, you have to be really multi-skilled these days.
I know.
And so many things. You have to produce the work, deliver the work. Edit the work. It's very multifaceted. It really is.
I think that there's an argument where comedians at one point probably didn't do enough work, whereby you could earn a very good salary for just doing 3 or 4 gigs a week.
Yeah.
And that was probably a full storm. I think we've overcorrected, is what I'm going to say.
Yeah, yeah. Gone the other way.
I did not get into this job to be getting up on a Monday thinking, right, I've got lots of things to do today. One thing that I think, you know, is potentially a good thing about the clips is that where the gatekeepers of television, you know, sometimes they tend to come from a certain kind of background, you know, very metropolitan, very middle class and stuff. And you know, so they go up to Edinburgh and stuff and they sort of say, oh, observational stuff, seen it, done it, you know, or stuff about men and women, seen it, done it. Whereas actually the general public are like, well, we sort of still like that stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, one of our friends that's done very well recently with her clips is Jen Brister. And it's really interesting to me is because obviously TV were like going, well, Jen, you know, they might look at her as a gay comic first and foremost, right? Whereas the public watching her going, well, like, she's a mum, you know, like the public have got a far more sort of pure take on things. So I guess there is did they just go, she's really great at comedy and she's talking about things that I understand. Whereas if you're in the TV world, you go, oh, this is a diversity thing. So we'll have that person or that person. So I suppose the one good thing about the clip stuff is that really good stand up does tend to shine through.
Yes. Yeah, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And it does sidestep those gatekeepers who at times, I mean, we know what, I mean, television makes no sense, does it? It makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. You know, you try and get your head around it and you try and wonder how certain things happen and how certain things get made and how certain people get to make certain things. And you're like, I don't understand this at all. Whereas, yes, it has entirely sidestepped that and provided another outlook on things. So yes, you're absolutely right, and that can only be a good thing. That can only shake things up. And then
that happened to an extent with someone like Paul Smith up in Liverpool, who was doing ahead of the curve and doing crowd work, which was very recognisable to us. Obviously, he's brilliant at it, and it's very distinctive. But then you've got a whole generation of youngsters who have gone, I've never seen this.
I know, I had somebody say that to me recently. They'd gone to see Paul and they were like, I've never seen anybody do this. I'm like, what, comparing? You know?
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, it was groundbreaking for them. I was like, well, fair enough. I mean,
but that is, again, that's a consequence of gatekeepers who've decided we've seen too much comedy, there's no audience for that. Mo Gilligan's another great example when he was doing those sketches.
He seemed to sidestep all of the club stuff, didn't he, really? And I never worked with him in the clubs at all.
What he was doing was sort of making broad brush strokes, like funny, warm observations about how men and women are, really. But he was doing it in a neat, modern way with sketches. And I remember when I was on the MASH report, there was they were putting out clips, and there was one clip that done particularly well, and it took them all by surprise. And they went, it's got 10 million views. And I said, what's it about? They said, well, it's sort of about the difference between Northerners and Southerners.
Oh, my God,
I went,
really?
Yeah. I went, well, that'll be it then.
Yeah, that's it. That's what people want.
Yeah.
They want it to resonate. They want it to be...
Yeah.
Comedy comes out of being recognisable. People go, it's... Those are the words that you hear when you speak to an audience afterwards. They go, relatable, recognisable.
Yes. Yeah.
I observed the same thing. You know, they feel clever if you've sort of held something up to it and gone, look at this. They go, I've also observed that. That's how that works. Yeah, yeah. It's and that's the community aspect of it. That's the connection. That's where the connection has to come from. And I like that connection in a room.
Okay, just interrupting the chat with Zoe there. I hope you're enjoying it. Just to say, well, let's give a shout out, as we haven't had any new patrons this week, to some existing patrons from the other tiers. We got Cyrus Reddy Campbell, which I don't think I could have read that out before. But thank you for your support. Cyrus Reddy Campbell. Sounds like one of those, you know, those wrestlers that came out in the mid-90s. It was only about for 2 weeks. Just a shit concept and a shit nickname. Cyrus Reddy Campbell. And he just came out to Cotton Eye Joe. Went out here, but he had this really, maybe had this really like kind of really problematic take on being like white trash. He just came out with like two teeth and he was just fucking, just like looking weirdly at his sister. Okay, let's move on. We got Dan Brown, the novelist for the Da Vinci Code. It's great that a novelist like Dan Brown would support my work. So if you want to be part of the Patreon community, just remember you go on Patreon, search Jeff Norcott, and you can join. There's any tier, you will have access to my last three comedy specials. Obviously, if you're VIP, you get guaranteed questions in the monthly Patreon-only episode. And also, I do throw out some of those questions to the other tiers as well. And of course, the book, pre-order the book. Just pre-order the book. Look, if I get to a point where the numbers suggest it will be enough to be on the Sunday Times bestseller list, I'll stop going on about it. There you go. There's the deal. I'll shut the fuck up if you pre-order the book. And then, of course, because there are no adverts on this podcast, by the way, that's what the Patreon does. It keeps it weekly and ad-free, but it does create time for me to hype all my own shit, is the tour. So there are several venues sold out now. I'm just saying that I'm confident that most of them will sell out. So this is, I'm saying this for you guys. I just don't want you to be disappointed. And the other good news is that there have been people asking me about dates, some notable places that I wasn't going, most notably Nottingham. If you just sit tight, next week I'll have some news on that. I mean, interestingly, at the moment, we're in an era whereby Frankie Boyle's New World Order was cancelled recently, and that's on the back of, you know, topical comedies like The MASH Report, which got its second cancellation. I think we should go for the hat trick.
The hat trick.
8 out of 10 Cats, the topical version, got cancelled from Channel 4. And cancelled is always said. It's not recommissioned. They're slightly different things. And obviously Mock the Week. I just thought that what was interesting is that, you know, a while ago there was this discussion. And obviously everyone told me I was a made guy. You know, when Tim Davies said we're going to change it, I was like, right, Roll up. I'm going to get booked on everything. But
yeah.
TV's kind of gone, actually, we'll just cancel all those shows because it's really fucking hard.
Yeah. What's left? Have I got news for you?
Have I got news for you? The news quiz is still doing great things. But
yeah.
I just think that, the thing that the public might not be aware of is it's really hard to get audience doing topical stuff. And I wonder again how much social media has played a part, because the ability to be ahead of the news cycle in a social media sense now is really, really hard, you know. And obviously the repeat, I think, and maybe the bigger thing is because for the last 15 years, something like Mock the Week would get repeated quite a lot and people didn't think it was weird. But then suddenly in about the last 5 years, repeats of topical shows are like, it's a whole fucking different world now.
Ed Miliband. Week. I mean, but that's that. We are, I guess, in an unprecedented time in political history where it seems to be calming down a little bit in this country at the minute. But you only have to pop over to France to go, they're kicking off. Look at that. Look at what's happening there. It's really hard to keep abreast of it and keep funny with it. But, you know, our Liz Truss jokes were redundant within 2 weeks. You know, that's the thing, you know.
No, well, so when will anybody really think of the material. Comics?
Yeah, so it's actually really tricky. Also, because of the streaming nature of news, because of the constant recycling and, you know, refreshing of it, yeah, it is really hard to keep abreast. And there are millions of people on Twitter who will be much funnier than I will ever be about things that are happening. And, you know, there are people that are specifically aiming at stuff like that. And actually, I can't compete with that. I'm not as quick as it seems like they're there just waiting to press the send button, you know.
Well, I might be able to think of a half-decent one-liner if a news story breaks, but then somebody within an hour could have a professional-looking sketch. Just think, there's no way that topical comedy can compete with that. I mean, I do think it's a shame in a way that there was this challenge of getting more diversity of viewpoint into topical shows, and that challenge was fully rejected by the TV industry. They're going, oh, fuck it, we'll make road trip shows instead.
I wonder if a road trip show,
one of the appeals of it in a way is because there is generally, you know, there are certain sensitivities now. Do they sort of work because if you get two people that seem to like and trust each other, they can potentially say things to each other that you couldn't say generally, if you know what
possibly.
I mean.
Like, yeah. Also, they're just a laugh. Sorry, I mean, I just did one with Joe Wilkinson. We did Turkey for the World's Most Dangerous Roads. And, I had a great time because I was with my mate. And I have to be honest, neither of us were particularly political in our observations as we gently rimmed Armenia.
You're telling me that the working gig that involved a holiday was somehow more enjoyable than
It was more enjoyable than driving to Plymouth and doing Club Fandango, I have to be honest. Yeah. So we drove up the Iranian border. It was interesting. I mean, it's... Like I say, when this tour finishes, I'm going to have a long, hard sit down and sort of think about which way I want to go after this. I want to do stuff that actually makes me feel. I want to do stuff that makes me feel happy. That's what I will do. And if that involves filming stuff and putting it up online, and I find I enjoy that, then I will do that. But I certainly don't want to be a slave to whatever this genre becomes. Life's too short for that, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, as you say, like things do change. There was this huge amount of panel shows, then it sort of slimmed down. I mean, you were a regular on Mock the Week. When you did it, was it in the scary bit of it? You know, there's that bit where it made comedians tense.
Tense, Jesus Christ. Yes, it was ulcer producing. It was absolutely, it was terrible. And also, I wasn't, when I first did it, I wasn't up to speed as to what was involved with what I should be doing, how to approach those sorts of panels. You know, I wasn't fully
You mean everyone else is using a whole team of writers?
I had no idea, Jeff. Yeah. It was only after I'd done a few of them and I went, oh, right, is that what people are doing? Oh, okay. It just wasn't, I wasn't aware. I mean, perhaps my own naivety, but... so I had to change the way I approached doing those. But yeah, it was. And again, when I started doing it, I was the only woman on the show. So again, you're just like an audience's eye would scan along the panel and go bloke, 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 bloke. Oh, what's that? Bloke, bloke. So you're always going to stick out, always going to stand out. And do you know what? Now that the time has passed and, you know, and the show is gone, I can say I fucking hated that. It's horrible. Because all the other blokes would be in each other's dressing room sharing, like, talking about jokes and stuff. And I never felt part of it. And actually, that was really hard. I mean, it wasn't always like that, but often it was. And I think I didn't give myself enough credit at the time for going, do you know what? This is a really tricky environment to be in. I already, you know, I am the only woman on the panel. Already audiences will have their opinion about that. Because you were the only one, people just went, she's only there because they've got to put one on. That's what you were. You were seen as the token because you were the fucking token.
So I've been there. You know, as the writer said, I'm not equating my struggle with that of women historically. But yeah, there was, I mean, look, there's a Venn diagram here. And I do think when you're the only one of one sex on a show, but like immediately I did feel that thing. And I started to understand how female comics felt, was that I knew that if I didn't do well, my failure would be held up as an example of previous stereotypes. So they would go, see, told you right wingers couldn't be funny, told you somebody, you know. So it does actually load the bases a little bit.
Yeah, totally, you know. Cause, yes, exactly. Like you say, so if I was to fail, if I was to be seen as failing on a show like that, then it was all women aren't funny. And you're like, Jesus Christ, really? Yeah. I mean... Yeah.
Well, I did it once. I was very mediocre when I did it. But one of the things that I found hard about it was that I was doing mock at the Mash Report at the time, and there was like an authored bit. You got to sort of drive the conversation, and then suddenly it was like bah, 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 bah. And the thing that I found really hard was obviously they'd start off on a subject, and I'd think, oh, I've got a few things I'd like to say on this, and then the banter train would start leaving the station.
Yeah.
And the banter train would suddenly the it would get very fast.
Yeah.
And I sort of felt like if you weren't on the banter train when it left the station, you could just find yourself standing on the platform. How did you sort of like fit in with that? I mean, you always looked very comfortable and funny on the show, but how did you feel about all the running jokes and stuff like that?
So the banter train, yes, I know exactly what you mean by that. And you could feel the slight panic sort of rising in your chest as you saw the conversation taking off without you. And it's like, oh, here we go. And that was the difficulty as well of I only ever got like one ep a series. So people who were getting more and sort of knew each other better have all those familiarities and have those in jokes, and you're just not part of them. What I learned to do was not panic. Because, of course, that show as well would famously record for about 3.5 weeks, you know, be cut down to a 28-minute show. So you knew that a huge amount of that was never going to get used. So I learnt not to panic, and I learnt just to let it roll. Because actually, there's nothing sadder, I think, than seeing somebody who's been left out of a conversation desperately trying to join in, like, guys, I'm here too still.
I mean, that was
so
the...
So I used to just let it roll and know that most of that won't go in.
There is always that thing on the panel show, which I think is a devastating moment where you do something that bombs, but then somebody tops it with a great joke and you go, well, that's fucking going in.
Yeah.
Like immediately you go, because normally if it bombs, you think, well, they won't use it. But if somebody comes in with something hysterical straight afterwards, I just always thought I should just swear now, just say the worst words imaginable to make this unusable.
Make it unusable, Or, as happened a few times, you say something, it didn't quite land, and then somebody says it. Almost exactly what you've just said, but louder. And then it lands, and you're like, oh, wow. Okay.
I had that on the news quiz once. I was talking, it was obviously while Brexit was still, it hadn't, you know, been enacted yet. And I was sitting next to a director of European studies. And I was saying something to him, and I was saying something to him about Europe. I was like, well, isn't it true that Europe this or Europe that? And I said, well, there you go. Brexiteer. And I took the piss out of myself, lectures, European expert. And then the audience went quiet. And then 2 minutes later, the host said that exact same thing and it got a round of applause.
Yeah, that's exactly.
And I thought, that was my fucking
joke.
That
was my line. I mean, it's a tough crowd. You must find that as somebody on the right. A Radio 4 audience is predominantly on the left, so you must find it
Well, they
quite
like
hard.
To seem like they are, but the thing is, you look at them, and obviously I've got, you know, like a gaydar once upon a time. I've got a Torydar where I go, and I'll tell you, there's
you
younger
have a
comics.
Second home in Cornwall.
What it was a challenge in respect of, I was swimming against the tide, but then if you can just play that for what it's worth, and if you're not being extreme, you could sort of surf that wave a little bit. But there were some times where I would say things. The hardest thing was when they misinterpreted me being ironic, because, again, if you've got like a working class accent as well, you throw that in with people knowing that you voted Leave, there's every chance they're not going to credit you with any self-awareness.
Yeah,
so I would sometimes say things ironically and they'd just go quiet, go, oh, they didn't realise that was a joke.
I get it. And you know, I found the whole gigging during Brexit was really, really interesting. It was really interesting, and I saw a lot of really heavy-handed, misjudged material slung out in places where I thought, you've really misread this room. Wow. You know.
Well, yeah, it was kind of weird because if you go at the very least, like, even in the most Brexity or Remainy places, you were probably talking about 60-40. So if you were in a room of 100 people and 60 people thought one thing and 40 another, you'd think this feels quite close to 50-50, right? So, and I saw the same. I thought people going out, just imagining that everyone thought exactly what they did.
Yeah, it was very interesting,
actually. From both sides, predominantly, I would say, more from the Remain side. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, even when I did the Comedy Store, two nights after the Leave vote happened, I was working with comics, and they were surprised by the fact that the audience weren't as kind of... One, the old punters were generally not as exercised about it, you know, as we were. And two, they've got parents that voted Leave, you know, or their partner voted Leave or their friend voted Leave. It was a real... It was a bit of a watershed in comedy, wasn't
it? Yeah, it really was. It was really interesting. And because we travel so much, we could see that there was such a split across the country. Whereas people in... I think people, but mostly in London and Brighton, you know, I'm based in Brighton and worked a lot in London, were genuinely surprised. I was like, well, you take a drive around. Have a drive around. You know, sniff the air. So I do... You know, I'm left-leaning, but I hope I never preach. I really didn't.
No, you don't,
learned
no.
that because, you know, because rooms are so diverse and you really don't know, you know, it's, there's nothing worse than
nobody, I think that is the last thing. I always thought that it was like you tell a joke and then you get to make your little point.
Yeah.
But there's no point without the joke. And I do wonder if, you know, since Brexit, because at first it was this new dividing line in society and people were surprised at who they disagreed with that they might have thought that they might agree with from before. But then we had COVID and then there was another issue where you go, oh, I thought you'd have been pro or anti-lockdown. And then there was a trans. And then there's been all these issues where I think now we're at a point we're going, oh, yeah, I guess people might have lots of different views on a bunch of stuff, which was the most obvious fucking thing in the first place. But I think Brexit was the first one that sort of lanced that boil in a way.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I do less and less topical stuff. I just do, you know, I rejoice in the silly these days. I rejoice in the silly.
I hear that. My show is called Basic Bloke. I mean, I've gone fully like I'm going route one. We should finish talking about the tour. It's called the Bald Ambition Tour.
Yeah, Bald Ambition. Yeah, called that because I went through quite a sort of tricky couple of years, you know, during and post pandemic, and lost most of my hair. It's growing back. Talking to you, I was looking in the mirror. I'm going through what I can only describe as my very, very tricky growing out phase because I've got like the weirdest looking mullet happening at the minute because it's growing on top, but it's short, and then I've got little long bits at the back. So I've got like a spectacular mullet.
Exceptional.
It is quite exceptional. It is quite exceptional. But I when it was happening, and I lost a lot of my hair. I lost about 85% of my hair. I had like a tuft basically. I really had to, again, I had to question whether I wanted to carry on doing stand-up because, you know, it's quite an exposing job anyway. And I didn't feel confident or happy with how I was looking at all. And I just didn't know how I was going to sort of carry on with it. So eventually got to a point where I was able to laugh about it and joke about it and talk about it. And I thought, you know what, Zoe, out of the back of this, get, you know, do something for you almost, you know, write the show and enjoy it. And it's been such a help. It's been such a massive help. I've met lovely, lovely, lovely people. I mean, the show's not just about losing my hair, but it's but of course it has to be addressed. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's a hilarious title, and that always is. People forget about titles are so important. I mean, I've gone Basic Bloke. That's more of an excuse than a title. But I think it's interesting with the touring thing. You know, you've done it for many years now, and you get to know areas. I've always thought that's a great privilege about this job, is that I wouldn't know half as much about this country as I do, but then randomly you know, I'll be in Loughborough.
Yeah.
And I'll go to a Chinese restaurant in Loughborough and I'll find out a little bit about Loughborough. Is there any places that you've just become really attached to that you love going back to and you think, you know, you've formed a bond with that city? And then conversely, is there that place where you can never sell and you just never, if something hasn't worked out for you with that city or town? So first up, maybe start with the second one first. What's the place where you people could do getting a shift on for tickets?
Probably tonight in Taunton, but this will go out way beyond this gig.
Well, let's deliver a review for Taunton.
A review for Taunton.
Mine's Leicester, although
Leicester as well.
Yeah.
Isn't that strange? And I don't know whether that's because I've just done Leicester, and I don't know whether it's just because it was a month after the comedy festival, whether that was badly timed on my behalf, you know. I find the smaller the towns, the better the turnout. So where was I?
They've got nothing else in their lives, have they?
It's more concentrated, isn't it? If you live in London,
Verwood.
Have you ever done Verwood in
Hampshire? It's a real place.
Yeah.
And you get the sense it's one of those gigs where everybody in the town comes to every single gig there because that's all they've got going on.
I'm writing that down. Verwood, next tour, right? Chorley, have you done Chorley?
In Lancashire.
Yeah.
I've got it next year, actually.
Such a delight. It's such an amazing little theatre. It's like a 250-seater. It always sells out. The people who run it are just beyond charming, and the audience are well up for it. And again, you go, why are you here? How did this happen? But surely, every time, I bloody love it. I turned down their Christmas lights a few years ago.
That's a good one. I mean, I think if you turn on any Christmas lights in your career, no matter what
where
size town, city, where it is, you did that.
Yeah.
And, you know,
yeah.
You opened a supermarket. That's
turned on their Christmas light. But surely, I was just in Barnsley. That was really lovely. And Darwin in Lancashire. Hmm. Really, really lovely. I find the West Country harder to sell. Don't know why.
The West,
and you think going back to all of those Club Fandango days, maybe they saw my early offerings.
Yeah, they've seen enough of us.
Yeah, they've seen enough.
Aberdeen is another tough one. But then
apparently that's
because it's a great gig, but that's because like apparently people that live there don't live there very long, or it's partly to do with the oil industry. But it's no fucking excuse, Aberdeen.
Take it off the list.
You took it off the list,
Aberdeen.
Yeah,
when they sent me through the list of proposed venues, I said, I don't want to go to Aberdeen.
Well, there you go. I think that in the particular in this week, is a good place to end, is that comedian cancels venue.
Yes. Yes. Aberdeen's been cancelled.
Cancelled by a comedian. That's what happens at Aberdeen. And look, if you don't buck up your ideas, other comedians will start to do it. So you need to show up to the party. So Zoe, where can people find tickets? Obviously, I guess your website, Google Zoe Lyons tour would be a good start.
So zoelyons.co.uk, all of the tickets are on there. Or on my Instagram, there's a link to it as well. So I've got 14 more dates to go, culminating in Brighton on the 14th of May at the Theatre Royal, which I'm really looking forward to.
A big one. So do get along to that or any of the dates that you can. And Zoe Lyons, thanks so much for appearing on What Most People Think.
Do you know, Jeff, it's been lovely to chat to you. I miss you, mate. We should see each other in the flesh more often.
Okay, that was the chat with Zoe Lyons. Do go and see her tour. You won't be disappointed. It's going to be a great show of stand-up. And as you know, as we discussed in our chat together, people just want funny now. People just want funny. We just got one letter this week, and this is from Matt. And it says, Jeff, thank you for continuing to run the podcast weekly and ad-free. Well, except for the Jeff plugs. What a week to mention that. I know on previous episodes, particularly mental health ones, you've talked about the impact journaling can have on mental well-being. Would it be possible in one of the questions in an upcoming podcast to cover off the best way to start journaling? As a bloke in his late 30s, the concept of writing my feelings daily is pretty alien, to say the least. Right. And he's also asking, should it be paper-based versus laptop? Free-form versus structured? 750 words? That's a very blokey way to come at it, isn't it? You want to get your process right. But I do understand that. Because if you've never done something before, it's just simply, what the fuck do I do? It's why people get so nervous on their first day at a new job. What do I do? Where do I go? And also, you mentioned the concept of writing my feelings is pretty alien. That is a barrier for a lot of blokes. I would say It depends. How do you normally write stuff? If you normally use a laptop to type, I would say at the very least use a keyboard. I think writing notes on your anything on your iPhone is too casual and it's too close to a lot of other stuff you'll be doing. So you've got to give it a bit of status, right? So either get your laptop and just open a Word document. That's what I tend to do. Or get a clean piece of paper. But no shit on it, basically. And a pen. Yeah, really, Jeff? A pen with paper? Yeah, I'm loads of advice here. I'm really helping men through. And just start off with perhaps some recent events. You know, it is hard to get started. So if you just start off with things that you went and did, or if there was a moment that you could think of where you didn't feel, where you didn't like how you felt, just start describing what happened. You know, so say maybe you was in a meeting, and you know, you're having a meeting and you just have like anxiety come over you for no fucking reason. Just think, I'm going to fucking lose it. Just try and think back how it started. Go, what was it? Was there a thought process? So I was sitting there. I knew it was going to be a 2-hour meeting, maybe. I thought we'd have already got through 40 minutes, but we'd actually only done 17. And that person from HR was still fucking talking. And then I started thinking how long I'd have to sit there. And then I felt a bit of anxiety. And then what you start working out is that there's a pattern to how you feel, which would be described more as cognitive behavioral therapy. Another one can be, if you had a weird dream and it freaked you out, you know, you can just sit there and go, all right, I'll give you an example here. I had a dream. Am I going to talk about this? This could be fucking misconstrued. I had a dream the other night where, I'm so regretting saying this, where Rishi Sunak appeared in my dream and said he had a mission for me. Now, I know that anybody listening to this is probably going to think, yeah, actually you're going to get back on the Tory bus and start shilling for them again. That's not... Anyone that's listening to the podcast would like, oh my God, I'm going to have to end the podcast. I wish I'd never said that. But you know, I said it. Yeah, I had a dream. If there's any fucking lazy writers at the Metro or whatever, you know, that just a right-wing comedian says, Rishi Sunak appeared to him like a deity in his dream. There you go. But you know, in answer to Matt, just start writing. But unlike me, maybe be sensible enough to not tell other people. Listen, man, I hope you have a great week and I'll be back early next week with another episode because I'm going on holiday and the wife doesn't want me doing any podcasts next week. So I'm going to record it Sunday. It's going to be up Monday and obviously there'll be the Patreon only on Friday as well. But have a great week and what's that? Order the book.